With automated systems, he had run his old ship, Shanidar, by himself perfectly well. He could go for months alone, deep in solitude, killing when the time came, finding solace in his drugged dreaming. But now he had a dozen men and women under his command, his responsibility, night and day. Diane had told him that Humphreys insisted on placing troops in his decoy ships. He wanted trained mercenaries who would be able to board Fuchs's ship and carry back his dead body.
"I tried to talk him out of it,"
Diane whispered during their last night together.
"But he won't have it any other way. He wants to see Fuchs's dead body. I think he might have it stuffed and mounted as a trophy."
Harbin shook his head in wonder that a man with such obsessions could direct a deadly, silent war out here among the asteroids. Well, he thought, perhaps only a man who is obsessed can direct a war. Yes, he answered himself. But what about the men who do the fighting? And the women? Are we obsessed, too? What difference? What difference does any of it make? How did Khayyam put it? The worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes, or it prospers, and anon, like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little hour or two, is gone. What difference do our own obsessions make? They turn to ashes or prosper. Then they melt like snow upon the desert. What difference? What difference? He heard his second in command asking,
"So what are we going to do? He's getting away," he said calmly.
"Obviously, he doesn't believe that we're carrying ores back to Earth. If we turn around and chase him, we'll simply be proving the point."
"Then what do we do?"
the Scandinavian asked. The expression on her bony, pale face plainly showed that she wanted to go after the other ship.
"We continue to behave as if we are an ore carrier. No change in course."
"But he'll get away."
"Or come after us, once we've convinced him that we're what we pretend to be."
She was clearly suspicious of his logic, but murmured,
"We play cat and mouse, then?"
"Yes," said Harbin, glad to have satisfied her.
It didn't seem to matter to her which one of the two ships was the cat, and which the mouse.
In Cellini, Douglas Stavanger stood by his office window, watching the kids out in the Grand Plaza soaring past on their plastic wings. It was one of the thrills that could only be had on the moon, and only in an enclosed space as large as the Grand Plaza that was filled with breathable air at normal earthly pressure. Thanks to the light gravity, a person could strap wings onto her arms and take off to fly like a bird on nothing more than her own muscle power. "How long has it been since I've done that?" Stavanger asked himself. The answer came to him immediately. "Too blasted long." He chided himself. For a retired man, you don't seem to have much fun. Someone was prodding the council to allow him to build a golf course out on the floor of Alphonsus. Stavanger laughed at the idea, playing golf in space suits, but several council members seemed to be considering it quite seriously. His desk phone chimed, and the synthesized voice announced, "Ms. Pahang is here." Stavanger turned to his desk and touched the button that opened his door. Jatar Pahang stepped through, smiling radiantly. She was the world's most popular video star, the flower of Malaya, a tiny, delicate, exotic woman with lustrous dark eyes and long, flowing, midnight black hair that cascaded over her bare shoulders. Her dress shimmered in the glareless overhead lights of Stavanger's office as she walked delicately toward him. Stavanger came around his desk and extended his hand to her. "Miss Pahang, welcome to Cellini." "Thank you," she said, in a voice that sounded like tiny silver bells. "You're even more beautiful than your images on screen," Stavanger said as he led her to one of the armchairs, grouped around a small circular table in the corner of his office. "You are very gracious, Mr. Stavanger," she said, as she sat in the chair. Her graceful frame made the chair seem far too large for her. "My friends call me Doug." "Very well. And you must call me Jatar." "Thank you," he said, sitting beside her. "All of Cellini is at your feet. Our people are very excited to have you visit us." "This is my first time off Earth," she said. except for two vids we made in the New China space station. I've seen those videos, Stavanger said, grinning. Ah, I hope you enjoyed them. Very much, he said. Then, pulling his chair a bit closer to hers, he asked, What can I do, personally, to make your visit more productive? She glanced at the ceiling.
We are alone?
Yes, Stavanger assured her. No listening devices here, no bugs of any kind. She nodded, her smile gone.
Good. The message I carry is for your ears alone.
I understand, said Stavanger, also fully serious. Jatar Pahang was not only the world's most popular video star. She was also the mistress of Zhu Xiangqing, chairman of the world government's inner council, and his secret envoy to Stavanger and the government of Selene.
The art of governing, thought Zhu Xiangqing, is much like the art of playing the piano. Never let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. It had been a long, treacherous road to the leadership of the world government. Xiangqing had left many friends, even members of his own family, by the wayside as he climbed to the shaky pinnacle of political power. The precepts of Confucius had been his nominal moral guide, the writings of Machiavelli his actual handbook. During his years of struggle and upward striving, more than once he marveled inwardly that he or anyone bothered even to try. Why am I driven to climb higher and higher, he asked himself. Why do I take on such pains, such risks, such unending toil? He never found a satisfactory answer. A religious man might have concluded that he had been chosen for this service, but Xiangqing was not a man of faith. Instead, he considered himself a fatalist, and reasoned that the blind forces of history had somehow pushed him to his present pinnacle of authority and power. And responsibility. Perhaps that was the true, ultimate answer. Xiangqing understood that with the power and authority came responsibility. The planet Earth was suffering a cataclysm unmatched in all of human history. The climate was changing so severely that no one could cope with the sudden, disastrous floods and droughts. Earthquakes raged. Cities were drowned by rising waters. Farmlands were parched by shifting rainfall patterns, then washed away by savage storms. Millions had already died, and hundreds of millions more were starving and homeless. In many lands, the bewildered, desperate people turned to fundamentalist faiths for help and strength. They traded their individual liberties for order and safety and food. Yet Xiangqing knew the human communities on the moon and in the asteroid belt lived as if the travails of their brethren on Earth meant nothing to them. They controlled untold wealth, energy that Earth's peoples desperately needed. Natural resources beyond all that Mother Earth could provide its wretched and despairing children. The giant corporations sold fusion fuels and solar energy to the wealthy of Earth. They sold metals and minerals from the asteroids to those who could afford it. How can I convince him to be more generous? To be more helping? Xiangqing asked himself every day, every hour. There was only one way that he could see. Seize control of the riches of the asteroid belt. The fools who plied that dark and distant region, the prospectors and miners and their corporate masters, were fighting among themselves. The ancient crime of piracy had reappeared out there among the asteroids. Murder and violence were becoming commonplace. The world government could send an expedition of peacekeepers to Ceres to restore order, Xiangqing thought. We could stop the mayhem and bring peace to the region, and thereby we could gain control of those precious resources. The prospectors and miners would grumble, of course. The corporations would howl. But what could they do in the face of a fait accompli? How could they protest against the establishment of law and peace along that murderous frontier? One thing barred such a prospect. Selene. The people of the lunar community had fought for their independence and won it. They would not sit back and allow